This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're going over Fools Rush In. So, if you haven't seen it and don't want us to ruin it for you, you may want to pass on this one and we'll catch you next time.
Hey, gentle listeners.
Are you ready
for one dry kiss?
I'm going to venture a guess and say, yes, yes, you are. Welcome to One Dry as Corinne hacks up along. Corinne, you still with us, Corinne?
Oh, my God. That will get cut out.
No.
I'm fine.
Everybody needs to know why your husky voice is so husky.
Oh, my gosh. You know, week three of a cough, it just has a way of wearing on you.
Welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy, irreverent love letter to rom-com movies, where this week we are doing Fools Rush In. And I am here with my lovely co-host, who I can't say I rushed into a friendship with because we've known each other since we were two, Corinne Edding.
Aww. And I am here with my co-host, who I would totally marry if I got her accidentally pregnant, Miss Tamara Cosio.
Wow, you think I'm that kind of girl, I guess.
You know.
Just going to sleep with any old person I've known for four decades, whatever.
I'll be there for you. These three words I swear to you. When they breathe, I want to be the air for you. I'll be there for you.
I'd really like to be the air for you, too, with all that coughing you're doing over there in your neck of the woods, Corinne.
Thank you.
What are we on, week six?
Oh, my gosh. I'm just, like, wondering, maybe I should give up going to the hookah bar. Maybe I should give up chain smoking. Maybe I should give up vaping. Should I get rid of my bongs? I don't know. There's water in there, so that could be soothing.
Stop licking those mildewy walls.
Oh, my gosh. Ugh. Gentle listeners, just for your reference, I do not smoke anything except my awesome behavior. Yeah.
That's smoke your awesome behavior.
I smoke my awesome behavior.
I was a little bummed today, Corinne.
Oh, tell me.
Today was the first Wednesday that we didn't have the lovely ladies of Let's Go to Court just spitting their wisdom in our ears. Because the lovely co-host, Brandy Pond, of course, as most of you probably know if you don't listen to that podcast, decided to take a step back and focus on her family. But instead of wallowing in my mourn, I decided to try some new things to embrace the change.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So I knew it was coming. So I've been trying to just, you know, like roll with the differences and trying things since like Sunday.
Okay.
And of course, Sunday, it's just, you guys are a little bit behind, but it was Easter.
Yes.
And Larry made a beautiful ham for Easter and we had the kiddos over.
Nice.
And I got all excited because I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to make beans. I'm going to use that ham hock and I'm going to put it in the crock pot and I'm going to make beans.
Okay.
I love recycling and I love leftovers are two of my favorite things because I am a cheap ass anyways. So I have not made beans a lot. So I took 3 bags of beans and soaked them overnight so we didn't get farty. Uh-huh. And I did not realize that beans expand. So
yes.
By the time my lovely 3 bags of beans were all soaked and ready to go, I had enough for a huge crock pot and a huge pot. So I made 2 big pots of beans and we've been eating beans since Sunday nonstop. And I gave a whole shit ton to family members, whether they liked it or not. So you might be doing some editing on this episode, Corinne. I'm just letting you know.
So you're like, so would you like some beans? Think we need, yes, you want some beans.
No, you're gonna get some. I'm not even asking. I'm just putting them in a gallon size Ziploc container and leaving them on your doorstep. Happy Easter.
Nothing says Easter like beans.
Oh man, I know. So that was my one thing. And then I also tried a new workout video this morning.
Ooh.
And the normal gal that I usually watch, she's called Mad Fit, and she does her exercise routines in 45-second increments with a 30-second rest. This new girl I tried this morning, she does 30-second increments with 10 seconds worth of rest.
Oh.
But in the 10 seconds, she's basically getting into the next pose and exercising, and that was not working for me because it takes me that long to get up off the floor.
Well, I've actually had to cancel my last 2 personal training appointments because of coughing out a lung and not being able to exert myself in any kind of discernible way. Otherwise, I sound like I am going to infect the world with some kind of plague. I mean, I feel really healthy other than the fact that I have this stinky cough. Mm-hmm. But like, regardless, it doesn't sound great when I sound like I'm hacking up a lung all the time.
Mm-hmm. Uncontrollable coughs are the worst. And I used to get them real, real bad when I used to smoke way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'd get sick, I'd get the nasty coughs, but they would linger the 5 to 6 weeks after. So I would feel fine. I wouldn't have a fever, but I would literally uncontrollably cough sometimes for hours. And it was just miserable. And still smoked after that. Go figure. Yay, 90s.
Well, you know, when I spoke with the nurse practitioner, she said to me, well, you know, you can't expect a cough to last 5 to 6 weeks. And I was like, Bleh. She's like, do you smoke? I was like, no, I don't smoke.
After all those lies you told us about the hookahs.
Uh-huh.
Come on, Corinne, come clean. We're all friends here.
Sure,
you
sure.
You can tell us.
Yeah, I go to the hookah bar all the time. You know how I love going places with lots of people, particularly ones who are smoking. Yay.
Mm, that's why we were friends in our teens.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, my gosh.
I can't believe that. 5 to 6 weeks. No, thank you. Can I give it back? I don't want that.
Seriously. Well, that's what my boss man told me when he left today from work. I said, I'm going to be following right after you. And he's like, great. And you know what? You should consider leaving your cough behind. And I was like, yes. Thank you, doctor. I will totally do that.
Yes. He doesn't listen to this, does he?
No, he doesn't. It's too long. Okay, are you kidding me?
Ass.
He tried listening to an episode and he was like, you know, your podcast is really long. I was like, yes, it's not for everyone. That's okay.
But I know. It is for me, the person that sits behind a desk alone for 8 hours.
Seriously,
and needs something
me too.
To fill the silence. So welcome. We're glad you're here too, gentle listeners.
Yes, yes, gentle listeners. Thank you for appreciating us.
Oh my gosh, there was another thing too. I watched a sitcom that I found on Hulu. I think it was called Taking Over the Burbs, but all the Musketeers of Diversity were there.
Ooh.
I was very excited. I was watching the whole thing. I only watched 1.5 episodes. I'm not sure if I like it yet. But when I was watching the first episode, I'm like, oh, it's diverse because it's a multiracial couple. Uh-huh. I think he's Vietnamese. And then I think she's Middle Eastern. And so they have two kids and they live on a block where there's like not a white person inside, basically. And then they went to go talk to their neighbor and she was disabled. So there was disabled representation. And then I'm like, oh, and then there was like all kinds of body sizes and shapes. And so I was like 10 minutes in going, oh, if only they had the gay representation. And then all of a sudden the daughter saw her old friend and then they were making eyes at each other. And I'm like, oh, no, there it is. There it is. All the Musketeers are present and accounted for. Okay. So even though I wasn't super feeling the writing in the first episode, I was like, everybody's here. Everybody's come to the party. I must give it a chance.
Uh-huh.
So
not with the full Musketeers. I really enjoyed watching School Spirits.
Still haven't watched that. That's what I have to watch. Well, this movie's not super inclusive, but I guess we'll find that out soon enough if Corinne wants to jump on in and give us that synopsis.
Well, we do have one Musketeer of Diversity firmly showing up to the table for this movie.
Glaringly so, yes. Outshining possibly the others. No, not quite, but it is there.
Yes.
It is loud and it is proud.
Yes. And Tamara, I have prepared the synopsis beforehand.
Ahead of time, before I was looking at you in the phone going, you ready to start? And you said, oh, shit. That's right. We're doing a podcast right now, and I need to do a synopsis.
Not this time. Not this time, Satan. Not this time.
I'm so proud of you.
You said, Corinne, can you please not be a fool and forget the synopsis?
Because fools rush in, get it?
Yeah. Also, don't rush into it. And I was like, I will not be a fool. Pity the fool. So I prepared my synopsis because your siren song called me back to the beginning.
And
because
I texted you 4 hours ago and said, don't forget the synopsis. I'm just kidding. I did not.
So, false rush in. Synopsis. Alex, played by Matthew Perry, rest in peace, is living his New York City dream life. He's building nightclubs on the fast track to a thriving, I don't know, club building career?
Yeah, it's that lucrative field that's growing right now.
Sure.
Building nightclubs.
Yeah, building nightclubs. When he temporarily moves out to Las Vegas to build his company's newest club, he ends up running into the enchanting Isabel, played by Selma Hayek, because she cut in front of him in the bathroom line at a restaurant. And they obviously have no choice but to sleep together.
Yeah, that's what you do when you meet somebody in the line.
Totally.
Never mind.
Yeah, you just...
Those are the people I meet in line are women. So let me scratch that statement.
However, that's just the beginning of their journey together. Well, wise men say only fools rush in because Alex can't help falling in love with Isabel. Keep those listening ears listening to find out.
How could he? It's fucking Selma Hayek. I am not trying to objectify the woman, but goddamn, she's a smoke show in this movie.
She is.
Holy cow.
And I've never seen this movie, which surprised the heck out of me because rom-coms, I love them. I think it's because Selma Hayek, like, she was not in, like, the peak of her popularity at the time. And Matthew Perry, who was in the peak of his popularity, I've never really been all that interested in him. And so...
Oh, my God.
So I think it just didn't draw me in because I was like, oh, Matthew Perry, whatever. And now, as this grown-ass woman, if I was like, a rom-com with Selma Hayek, yes, sign me up. I would be all in. But at that point in time, I was a shallow bitch. And I was just like, who's that man? Not interested. So, yeah. So, Tamara, are you ready to delve into Fools Rush In?
Yes, and I'm going to apologize in advance for the Spanish that I injected in the first part of the outline and then quickly realized what a bad idea that was and took it off the rest. So it's going to be me attempting to pronounce some Espanol, and that is not a language I am at all familiar with speaking. So,
well, I'm so excited. I thought you were going to like weave more into my parts, and I was like, I'm too lazy to write this out. Never mind.
No, I did it the first part, and I'm like, that took entirely too long. No.
Yeah.
Veto. Yes. Let us rush in, shall we? We suffer no fools. We open on Christmas in New York in all its glory. Twinkling lights, bustling streets, and thousands of people trying to do last-minute holiday shopping. And pushing through them all like a salmon going upstream is Alex, played by Matthew Perry. He's got headphones on, is holding a 6-foot stuffed marlin, and is repeating the word arigato, arigato, arigato. He gets to a bank of elevators where his coworker sees him and says happily, hey Alex, you in town long? Alex shakes his head and answers, nope, next stop is Tokyo. We next cut to central Mexico, pretty much the middle of nowhere, which is a stark contrast to the cold, crowded city. It's a bright, sunny day, and Isabel is floating lazily on a river on an inner tube.
Did you notice the water? In that river?
No.
It was mud brown. It was the most unappetizing looking water. I was like, that water is stagnant and gross and eh.
Yeah, no, I did notice that it was brown. I thought there was something more interesting than its brownness. Yes, I did see that. It was about as brown as if you've seen the old Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Gene Wilder, the chocolate river. Pretty much looks like this stream in Mexico.
Chocolate river, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And to be clear, we're not casting dispersions on Mexico's rivers and their clarity.
No.
Just this movie and that river that lies therein.
There's many a brown chocolate river in our old neck of the woods, San Jose, that I just floated down. So, no. I will call it what it is. A brown, murky river.
Mm-hmm.
She's being watched by a couple of boys who are around 8 and 10 who are hiding poorly in a bush, and she calls out to them in Spanish, ¿Cuánto tiempo llevas siguiéndome? And that is complete. If that is wrong, I apologize again. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Very, very sorry. Which means, how long have you been following me? The older boy answers back, ¿Desde que robaste mi cámara de aire? Which is, since you stole my inner tube. Isabel promises she was going to bring it right back after her little float, and the younger boy shouts back happily, keep it! He's in love with you! But he says that in Spanish, but I decided not to try to butcher that, so I'm just going to say it in English. In Spanish, it would have been...
Sigue, así él está enamorado de ti.
And if you didn't notice, gentle listeners, Corinne's Spanish is better than me. And we said that a couple of times in this podcast before because she learned it and went to Costa Rica and actually used it. Whereas my family wanted us to be a predominantly English household.
So fun.
Fun. And it's no wonder that he says that, because Isabel is played by Selma Hayek, and she is stunning.
Yes.
She bids the boys goodbye and Feliz Navidad, but not before the younger boy asks if she's going to marry the policeman. She shrugs sadly and says, I don't know.
Mm. Back in New York, Alex makes it up to his work office, and there's a holiday party in full swing. Alex yells to the crowd, what are y'all doing? Don't we build nightclubs anymore? His coworker responds, not during the holidays, and offers him some sushi. Alex looks at him appalled, covers the Marlin's eyes, and walks away, whispering reassuring words into the dead fish's ears. He was joking, and although this little bit lends nothing to the storyline, Tamara included it because she found it to be delightful and because it's quintessential Matthew Perry, R.I.P.
Yes, and I do have to say, like, if you love Matthew Perry in Friends, you will love him in this movie because he's basically the same character.
Yeah.
And although he is great in his Matthew Perry-ishness, he's not super great on the romantic front when he was doing some of those deep romantic moments. I'm like, oh, no, that's not good. So I do admit it's not flawless, but it is definitely quintessential Matthew Perry.
Oh, he did fine.
Sorry, continue.
Yeah.
Might point out the parts where I beg to differ.
Okay. And Corinne, me, kept on thinking, someone's gonna get stabbed by the Marlin. He's just like swinging that thing around and sword is everywhere this way and that, and there's lots of people around, and I thought that was an accident waiting to happen.
And it was never explained. He never explains why the hell he was carrying a huge Marlin with a sword nose throughout Manhattan.
Well, you're going to put it on your wall in your office. Duh.
Oh, sure. You think you might get it delivered then instead of carrying it from the airport, which is what they were implying.
That's because he came back from, like, probably building a nightclub in Puerto Rico or something like that, or Florida or something.
Again, shipping it probably would have been less expensive than bringing it on the plane with you and potentially buying it a seat because it was that big.
If it's his emotional support, Marlin, then he doesn't need to worry about paying for the seat. The seat gets paid for by the airline.
Got it.
Yeah.
He did say a snarky comment to his coworker that says, what's with the Marlin? He goes, oh, it's a keychain, which is like, it's a 6-foot fucking stuffed fish with a pointy nose. That was also pretty funny, but I didn't include it because we don't have the time.
I missed that line. Good line. But there's no joking when Matthew's work bestie Jeff pulls him aside and divulges, don't get mad, but Charlie Peters got Tokyo, you're going to Vegas. Alex is livid and exclaims, Vegas? Why am I going to Vegas? Everything famous about Vegas is leaving it. That song, the movie, hell, even the mob left Vegas. Alex is getting a bit loud, so Jeff drags him into the supply closet and tells his friend conspiratorially, listen, I could get fired for this, but I just closed a deal on a 50,000 square foot property in the middle of Manhattan. If you play your cards right and don't get distracted, you could be heading the sweetest deal this company has seen. And guess who's still going to be eating sushi in Tokyo? His face breaks into a wide smile and they simultaneously say, Charlie Peters! Alex gleefully hugs his friend as the supply closet door opens, and there stands their boss, who says seriously, you know, we have conference rooms for that. The guys masterfully feign, it's a support supply closet, and Jeff just needed a hug because the holidays are so hard for him since he got divorced. Which reminds me, I'm on a dating app right now, and there is a person on this app who, I kid you not, his profile picture is a picture of him in his child's bedroom wearing a shirt that says, I heart my crazy wife.
So when's your date with him?
Oh, any moment now.
Did he match with you? Did he match with you?
I did not match with him, but he liked me, so yay!
All right. You have to go on that date. Let me know exactly where you are and what time you should be back, and then tell me everything.
Yeah, you need to put app on me.
Find my phone. Just put find my phone on you. But then you go out there and then come back and tell us all about it. That sounds like a fucking podcast episode in itself.
Oh my gosh.
Corinne's bad dates.
Ooh. Oh, I have plenty to share. Yes, with you. I know. Thank you.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
We could have at least 12 episodes already.
Ooh, yikes. So yeah, it's been hard for him since he got divorced. I hope that he is smart enough as a single man not to wear a shirt that says, "I heart my crazy wife." As they exit, the boss man tells Alex unceremoniously, "I'm going to need you in Vegas." And Alex happily accepts since he's in the know now. Winky winky.
When we next see Alex, he's knee-deep in Vegas nightclub building. He's on site with the construction crew and an assistant who's handing him a set of keys. They're to his rented house that he'd prefer to live in because hotels are too distracting. Alex is very much a workaholic because later that evening, he's alone, plugging away on building plans over dinner at a Mexican restaurant. Did you see how many goddamn entrees he had?
Thank you! Thank you! I was like, wait, stop there!
Yeah, no. I didn't put it in the outline, but I'm like, we must discuss. Because he had like literally 18 plates on that table.
There were so many different dishes. I was like, is he also a food reviewer? I was confused. Uh-huh. I thought there was going to be more allusion to the variety of plates that he had on his table. But no, there was no explanation for the bevy of platters.
I'm sure he's one of those guys that just says, bring me one of everything. I don't know what I'd like.
Oh my gosh. Ugh. Like literally the entire table was covered in plates.
And it wasn't a small table. It was like a table for like 10 people.
Yeah.
It was covered in food and just him and his papers.
Yes.
Oh, Lord. Anyways, he uses the bathroom, and while he's in line, he overhears a conversation on a payphone. It's Isabel talking to her bestie, Lainey. She's practicing a breakup speech that she plans on giving her boyfriend, Chewy, because she loves him, but she's not in love with him. Isabel exclaims excitedly, "And I asked for a sign, and you know the necklace he gave me? Well, it broke." Isabel's bladder ultimately interrupts the call, but when she hangs up, she's dismayed to see that the bathroom line is 10 people deep, and there is only one restroom in this Mexican restaurant.
You know, at a place where you serve beans, you gotta have more than one restroom.
Uh-huh.
I'm just saying is all.
And alcohol. That stuff goes right through you. That's why their line was so long, because they only had one bathroom.
Ooh.
She smiles flirtatiously with Alex, who's at the front of the line, and says, "I was here, but I had to use the payphone, and then the line moved, but I couldn't move with it because the cord wasn't long enough." Alex is charmed, but looks behind him and says, "If I let you cut, I might get killed." Isabel assures him, "I can pee really fast. I grew up with 5 brothers, 2 cousins, and 1 bathroom. No one could pee as fast as me."
That
is a lot of people for 1 bathroom. So we're going to have to time you, Corinne.
I call myself the fastest pee in the West.
Alex smirks. "Oh, a gold medalist. This I gotta see." While they're waiting, Alex asks, "Do you really believe all that sign stuff? It seems pretty heavy for a Friday night." Isabel playfully accuses, "Do you always listen to people's conversations?" And Alex counters, "Do you want to go to the back of the line?"
Ooh.
She chuckles and explains that she's very religious and signs are a part of that. She believes that everything is destined to be. When Alex isn't buying it, she says very sultrily, "Oh, that's too bad. You see, I believe there's a reason beyond explanation that brought you to this very spot at the exact time that I was brought to this very spot."
Ooh.
Alex leans in expectantly and says, "Oh, really? And why would that be?" Isabel smiles mischievously and says, "So I wouldn't have to wait in line to pee," and then disappears into the restroom that just became available.
I feel like that is something that you would say.
Oh, yes. And I would mean it because, woo, when you gotta go, you gotta go.
Uh-huh. We cut to the next morning, and much to my surprise, Alex and Isabel are sleeping curled around each other in post-coital bliss. Excuse me? Baking powder?
Try saying that 3 times fast. Post-coital bliss. Post-coital bliss. Post-coital bliss.
Woo, you did good. They went from light banter in the bathroom line to totally nakies with each other. Who saw that coming? Not me.
Well, Matthew Perry's charming and Selma Hayek.
That's
also
true.
Pretty damn charming.
Yes. I feel like I missed something in the middle. There wasn't even a dry kiss between them.
I know. You had to use your imagination.
And I did. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. You should see this flip book that I made. Isabel slowly wakes up, realizes that she slept with the bathroom guy, and curses quietly to herself, untangling her panties from the sheets and sneaking out. Next, we see Alex, 3 months later. And what's he up to? He's still on the job site, but much more progress has been made on this nightclub. And now, Jeff is there to assist him. Jeff's in the construction bungalow on the phone. Ooh, construction bungalow. Nice.
Construction bungalow.
Construction bungalow.
It's the name of my new band.
Ooh, I like it. What do I get to play in the band?
Nothing. Oh. I mean, that's why I didn't tell you about it. I'm so sorry. You can play the tractor, Corinne. You can play the tractor.
That doesn't belong in a band.
Does in the construction bungalow band.
Jeff's in the construction bungalow on the phone when Alex finds him and happily informs him that he's managed to get an appointment with the head of the Alcohol and Liquor Bureau, which might be tricky because of some new zoning laws. Really? In Vegas? Where you can drink on the street? But regardless, they have to woo her. Jeff delightedly exclaims, "She sounds blonde, very blonde." Alex threatens, "Do not sleep with her." But Jeff is already having fantasies of his sexcapades with the very blonde woman. However, his reverie is interrupted by another very blonde woman who is outside and quickly approaching their construction bungalow. He says, "Oh, incoming." Alex follows his gaze, gets a panicked look on his face, and says, "I can explain," then dives under his desk right before a young, attractive blonde woman opens the door, saying, "Alex," in a sing-songy voice. Jeff apologizes to her, explaining that Alex just left, and the girl's face falls. She introduces herself as Catherine Stewart and explains that they're old family friends, and she's been unsuccessfully trying to get a hold of him. Just then, Donna, Alex's assistant, comes in asking, "Where's Alex?" Jeff informs her, "He went to the store." Donna points out, "His car is still there." Jeff responds pointedly, "He took a bulldozer, okay, Donna?" Donna can read between the lines and smiles, says, "Okay," and backs out the door. Catherine is disappointed and sighs. "He's always in three places at once, isn't he?" Jeff agrees cordially, and Catherine leaves. Once she's out of earshot, Jeff accuses, "You've been avoiding that?" Alex, still under the desk, responds, "Since the third grade."
Wow. I want to know the backstory behind that.
Yeah, you got to avoid the total blonde smoke show. Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Well, I just want to know what type. I mean, I can see she's kind of. Never mind. We'll get into it. We'll meet Kathy a little bit later in the story. Later that evening on the patio of Alex's rental house, Alex and Jeff are having the meeting with Tracy, the blonde head of the alcohol commission. She's a bit of a cougar and keeps trying to put the moves on Alex. He's not into it, but Jeff is trying to convince him, saying, "Quid pro quo! Quid pro quo!" I can say that better. Quid pro quo! But damn it!
You did it good the second time.
Quid pro quo. Wow. I can say fucking, what was?
Oh, yeah.
I can say poistcoital bliss, but I can't say quid pro quo.
Well, that time you said poist, so yes, but yes.
Damn it! Just let me have my moment, Corinne. You know you have to talk in podcast, don't you?
Yes, you talk real good in podcast.
Good thing I'm so well at it. But Alex is saved by the bell, sort of. Jeff leaves to get more wine, so his buddy and Tracy can be alone.
Ooh.
But when he opens the front door, there is Isabel. She was about to ring the bell, but upon seeing Jeff, apologizes, thinking she has the wrong house. Jeff tells her if she's looking for Alex, she has the right house and invites her right in. Then quickly goes outside and tells Alex he has a visitor, practically waggling his eyebrows. When Alex comes back inside, he's thrilled to see her, admitting, "I've been trying to track you down for months, but you didn't leave me much to go on." She seems relieved and admits that she snuck out because she'd never done anything like that before. Mm. That being the one-night stand...
You know, it's not a one-night stand if you give the person their number and you continue to date. Just saying.
Oh, is that how that works?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
I just thought I was in the middle of a 2-year one-night stand.
I know. So. It's like you build it better as you go along. Yeah.
I guess I can stop taking that walk of shame every morning since I live here.
You look good taking that walk of shame every morning.
Thank you.
During your 2-year one-night stand. It's impressive.
Alex admits that he never did anything like that either and scrambles around the kitchen trying to find something to offer her. But all he has to drink is water.
Oh, wait. Okay, but on the counter, there's one thing on the counter. It's saltine crackers, because nothing goes better with wine than saltine crackers.
Oh, yes. He's entertaining the head of the alcohol commission and probably knew that she didn't want to eat. She just wanted to drink.
Mm-hmm. And what's better to drink than something salty? Thus, the saltine crackers. You know, when you dip saltine crackers in wine, it's a really nice combination, you know?
No. I tasted that in my head now. I remember my grandmother used to give me saltine crackers with butter on them when I'd go to her house when I was sick and had to stay home from school. And I like butter on saltine crackers. They're surprisingly good. It's one of those what the situations. Isabel says water's fine. And as he hands her the glass, he asks, "So how have you been?" Isabel takes a big drink and says flatly, "Pregnant." Alex takes the glass from her and says, "Really?" and begins chugging the rest of the agua, probably wishing it was something stronger. Mm-hmm. Isabel assures him it's his and there's only one thing to do. Alex, thinking she means an abortion, practically falls on his knees, gushing, "Oh, thank God! I've always believed in a woman's right to choose." Isabel's face hardens a little and she says, "Well, good, because I choose to keep this baby. But I thought the honorable thing would be to tell you I'm pregnant, that it's yours, and I'm keeping it. But don't worry, I don't want anything from you." Just then, Tracy and Jeff come in. Tracy says she's feeling a little bit neglected, and they should go to dinner, while giving Isabel a little bit of the stink eye. Isabel apologizes for coming at a bad time and practically bolts out the front door. Alex lets her leave, but when he sees her a little later parked in front of his house with her head on the steering wheel, he changes his mind. She notices him looking and speeds off, and he tells Jeff and Tracy that he'll meet him at the restaurant and chases after Isabel while a song saying, "Para donde vas, muchacha? Para donde vas?" plays in the background.
Donde vas, cha-cha.
See, my accent's good when I sing. It's just when I talk that fucks it all up.
Okay, two things. First, this alcohol commissioner, you know, it's like the movies of the 90s were like, you know, okay, we realized that men trying to get sexual favors from women is no longer cute and funny. But you know what is funny? Women trying to exploit men for sexual favors instead. And so this woman is like, "I'm feeling mighty parched over here. My desert's been very dry. Care to moisten it up?" And
oh, God.
And Alex is like, "I am not interested." But Jeff is like, "No, you want to sleep with the commissioner, winky, winky. Let me leave you alone, winky, winky." And I'm like,
"It'll solve all our paperwork problems, winky, winky."
And he's like, "I would sleep with her if it was me, and you're a man, so therefore you must want to sleep with anything with boobs and a heartbeat, winky, winky." And Alex is like, "No, not really." But I'm just like, nah. Not cute, not funny. Mm-mm.
It was a little interesting trope that they held on to for a little while when, you know,
uh-huh.
It was in bad taste for men to try to, like, con trick, talk girls into sleeping with them.
Oof. And also, gentle listeners, I don't want you to worry. Apparently, Alex used condoms. Lots of them. It's just that one of them failed, but both couples were playing safe.
Yeah. And that's what they said in the conversation, which I couldn't include because this fucking movie is full of great one-liners. We use condoms. Lots of them. Well, one of them didn't work. What do you mean it didn't work? That's its job. A condom's job is to work. Said in the voice of Chandler Bing.
Ah, beautiful. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chandler. Isabel doesn't realize Alex was following her. So when she's sitting on a ledge overlooking the Hoover Dam, she's surprised to hear him calling out to her. Don't do it. Don't jump. Isabel yells back. I'm not going to jump, stupid, but if you come any closer, I'll throw your ass over. This miffs Alex, and he says, hey, you left without a word at 5 a.m, then show up 3 months later saying you're pregnant, and I'm supposed to know exactly what to do? Well, I'm sorry. I don't know exactly what to do. Her face softens, and she says quietly, that's the best thing you've said all night. Alex tentatively sits beside her, then marvels at the view below. Isabel tells him, it's one of my favorite places to come to. My great-grandfather traveled up from Aguascalientes in the 30s to work on it. Alex looks at her confused and says, from where? Isabel chuckles and tells him, it's in central Mexico, and my grandmother still lives there in a 400-year-old hacienda. Every time I visit her, I drive over the bridge and I toss a coin into the river and make a wish right in the middle of the state line. Alex absorbs all this information, and gentle listeners, you should too, because it comes back later. And Alex asks, is there anything I can do to help? She hesitates only a moment before saying, meet my family. That way, when the time comes, they'll know who the father is because I brought him home once. Alex is game and says, just tell me when. And she spins around, planting her feet on the ground before stating pointedly, when? They get in Isabel's car and drive. Alex is surprised to learn she has dinner with her family every weekend, and they work quickly to get to know each other during the drive. Isabel's the youngest of six with 5 older brothers. Her father's very protective, and she works at Caesar's Palace as a camera girl to pay the bills, but her real passion is landscape photography, and she's working on a book of the desert. She gives more details about her extended family and has been talking nonstop right up until arriving at her parents' gate. But before they walk through the gate, Alex stops her and says, wait, what's your last name? She smiles nervously because she can't believe she forgot something so basic. She tells him, Fuentes, and he tells her his last name is Whitman, before shaking her hand and saying sweetly, it's nice to meet you, Isabel Fuentes.
That's one of the moments where I'm like, oh, see, he's trying to be all warm and gushy. And he just looks kind of, to me, he looks a little smarmy because he lifts up his eyebrows and he's like, it's nice to meet you, Isabel Fuentes, with this like eyebrow cock. And I'm like, no, is that your attempt at sexy? Just then, Isabel's brother Juan comes out and sees the couple. When Isabel introduces her brother to Alex, Juan guffaws and says, ha, and I almost didn't come tonight.
And you know that Juan has his pocket popcorn ready to go.
Right. Well, he would have, but he had to go get ice. But he went real, real fast because he wanted to watch the show with his pocket popcorn. The two head to the backyard where there is a festive party going on. 30-ish people are milling around, chatting, playing music, dancing, and laughing. Alex looks shocked as he says, this is a family dinner? And Isabel nonplussed says, yeah, I guess a lot of people couldn't come tonight. As the crowd notices the newcomers, the music stops and all the relatives murmur to each other in hushed tones. Isabel breaks the quiet by saying, what's wrong with you all? Can I bring a guy over to dinner? Just then, a handsome brown man with a serious face wearing a police uniform comes over and asks Isabel, ¿Cómo estás? Her face falls and she says quietly, I'm fine, Chewy. It's been a long time since you've come to one of these. I didn't think we'd ever be friends again. Chewy stares at Alex while saying, why not? That's how we started. The party ultimately resumes again, and when all eyes are no longer on them, as Isabel tells Alex that Chewy is her ex-boyfriend, Alex, half-joking, asks, oh God, he's going to kill me, isn't he? She pulls him towards the house while saying,
He's not the one you need to worry about.
Okay, but also, he introduces himself to Chewie as Luke Skywalker, and he's like, I'm sure you get that all the time. And I'm like thinking, you know who he should have introduced himself as? Okay, I'm not really familiar with the Star Wars, you know, whatever universe, but like, he should have introduced himself as Han Solo, because A, he's like the hot hottie, B, he and Chewie are besties for life. So, like, why would he introduce himself as fucking Luke Skywalker? It makes no sense.
Maybe he's not a Star Wars nerd either, and that's the first name you could think of. He was trying to make a bad joke, and it didn't land to anybody, including Corinne.
It took me a while to figure out. I was like, why is he introducing himself as Luke Skywalker? I don't get it.
Get it? Because his name's Chewie.
Yeah, I know. I finally figured it out. But, you know, like, we went to school with people named Chewie. So it's like, you know, it's just... it's just in, like, the general vernacular, you know, where we grew up. So I'm just, you know.
Right. But Alex Whitman is from Manhattan. Yeah. And perhaps Chewie is way more foreign to them.
What? What? Yeah.
Wonder if he, like, actually thought it was him, like, his nickname that was short for Chewbacca.
Uh-huh. Probably.
Once inside, Isabel is greeted warmly by her mother, Amalia, and her father, Tomas. But Dad's face falls when he notices Alex and asks accusingly, who's this guy? Isabel introduces Alex, stumbling for a second before remembering his last name, Whitman, my boyfriend. This throws her father into a rage, and he complains loudly that he can't keep track of her. One minute she's engaged, and the next she's bringing home a man in a tie. Alex tries to gain favor by telling him, well, that's one of my favorite things about your daughter. She's always full of surprises. Isabel smirks, understanding the undercurrent of that statement, and Mama, who's infinitely kinder than her husband, whisks Alex away into another room so Isa and her father can talk. On the walls are beautiful desert photos, and Alex compliments them. Amalia's taken aback and says, they're Isa's. Haven't you seen them before? He quickly recovers and says, oh, yeah, but looking at them is like seeing them for the first time. He sees one of the smaller ones and adds, oh, this must be the house in Mexico. Amalia smiles and confirms this, pointing out the flinty-eyed little old lady who's leaning against the hacienda wall and says, that's Isabel's great-grandmother. They have a very special connection because they both have wild spirits. And this is punctuated by Isabel arguing loudly with her father in the next room.
The rest of the night goes smoothly, and the family gradually accepts Alex. And I gotta say, he, like, does his best to ingratiate himself to the family.
Yes. But it's not hard. I'm going to say, like, I didn't grow up in this environment for the most part, but my sister married into a very large Mexican family that was kind of a mirror image of these people. And they were all like, hey, how's it going? And they just, like, embraced you. And they're like, yeah, come here. Let's feed you. Let's get you something to drink.
Yeah.
Like, so it's probably not hard.
No, but I mean, he does things to try and, like, ingratiate himself to the parents and different things like that. Yeah.
Why wouldn't he? He's going to be like, I'm going to sit here and glare at you all because you're all a bunch of weirdos and strangers to me.
That's cool. Fine. Be that way. See if I care. I'm going to go over there and play cornhole with Chewie.
That sounds sexual a little bit.
Oh, I'd play cornhole with Chewie. Are you kidding? He's cute. Isabel's sister-in-law even asks him to hold her baby so she can make a plate. Alex tries to protest, but before he knows it, the little girl is in his arms while the mom says, watch her head. Alex nervously asks, why? Does it come off? But he seems to quickly embrace the task at hand and the baby. Isabel sees him from across the room. He looks at her meaningfully over the baby's head, and she smiles a little sadly. At the end of the night, the last of the guests are leaving, and Alex is marveling about how close her family is. He never knew people actually talked to each other over dinner. Then he has a realization and says sadly, they're going to hate me, aren't they? Isabel assures him, no, I won't let them, and thanks for coming. She turns away sadly and begins clearing up, but when their eyes meet, they rush across the patio and kiss each other passionately. That kiss tractor beam was like, bzing! Isabel finally breaks away, and we next see her driving him back to his car at the dam. Alex pleads with her to at least take his number so they can keep in touch. But Isabel implores him, just leave it alone. It'll be easier this way. At the dam, they tell each other to take care, and she tries to drive away, but he has a change of heart and stands in front of her car. Great, great idea. Just super great idea. Yeah.
He's full of them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He's blocking the way. She yells at him to move, but he wants to say something. Alex tells her, this afternoon, I couldn't decide between the Texas burger or the tuna melt sandwich, but my life made sense. And now I know exactly what I want, and my life doesn't make any sense. Somewhere between the tuna melt and your aunt's tamales? He trails off, trying to gather his thoughts, and Isabel looks touched by his words before he continues. I was always worried that I already met the woman of my dreams, but I was too busy to notice her. And then you show up, and I realize that that's not true, because you are the one. You are everything I never knew I always wanted. I don't know what that means, but I think it has to do with the rest of my life, and I think we should get married now.
It's the best line. I love that line.
Yeah.
You are everything I never knew I always wanted. So good.
It is. It's so good. I love that line, too. When he's like, at first, I couldn't decide between a sandwich, but I understood my life, and now I don't understand my life, but I know exactly what I want. And I'm like, oh, so good. So mm-hmm. good.
Between the tuna and the tamales, those tamales will change your life, Alex.
Yes, they will. A good tamale, you just got to buy it out of the back of a guy's trunk. That's all I'm saying.
I know. It's always hit and miss, though. Damn it.
My dad would do that. He would be like, I saw a guy on the side of the road selling tamales.
Same.
Yeah.
It's the only time that it's acceptable to buy something off the back of somebody's car.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every time I go to the parking lots here in Southern California, somebody approaches me with their trunk up and I'm like, huh? They're like, chuparado? And I'm like, no, damn it. You don't got any tamales? No. Fuck. All right. Aguas frescas? No. Tamales. Tamales? You know where the tamale people are?
Well, Isabel must have said yes, because we get a montage of their wedding night while the song, Ain't That a Kick in the Head, plays in the background. They get hitched in a Vegas chapel where Isabel is given away by Elvis. How romantical. They sign their names as husband and wife as they check into the honeymoon suite. Isabel changes into a sexy negligee as Alex opens champagne. The cork pops right at the moment he sees her. Oh! They make love. And the next morning, Alex wakes up to an empty bed. Is this a repeat? No. Isabel's just watching the sunrise, and when he finds her, he puts his arms around her and kisses her neck.
The next day at the job site, Jeff is miffed that Alex ducked out on their dinner plans. Alex is being a little elusive about his whereabouts, but Jeff demands answers. Alex goes on a diatribe about how dating's stupid and you can spend years courting the wrong person only to wind up divorced. Alex asks his friend, I mean, how long did you date your ex-wife before you married? 5 years? Jeff grimaces and says, I can't believe you're bringing up the word marriage with me. Just then, Donna emerges from the construction bungalow and yells, Alex, the phone's for you? She said she's your wife? Alex is grinning from ear to ear as he responds, ask her if I can call her back. Oh, and get her number. Jeff is incensed and yells, no, Donna, the only wife around here is my ex. Donna disappears back inside, and Jeff sees his friend waggling his ring finger, which now has a ring on it, and cries, you married her? The one with the body? Does my life mean nothing to you? Alex is still grinning like a fool as he responds happily, you're just mad that I won on the first spin while you've been pumping quarters into the wrong machine for 5 years. Jeff puts his finger in Alex's face and retorts, those were silver dollars, my friend, and that machine now owns my house. And why would you marry her unless you knocked her up?
Ooh.
Alex looks at his friend seriously over his sunglasses, and Jeff cries louder, you knocked her up? Alex, has it never crossed your mind that this baby might not be yours? Alex balks, Isabel's not like that. You don't know her. Jeff says, neither do you. Just then, a strange noise is heard across the construction site. Alex's ears perk up as if he senses danger, and he's right, because in the distance, speeding towards him is... Find out with us after this break.
Ooh. And we're back. Speeding towards Alex is a huge white pickup truck. It breaks through a lumber partition and lands in a pool of wet concrete. Tomas, Isabel's father, emerges from the driver's side wielding a bat. He approaches Alex and raises it as if he's going to strike him, while saying with rising anger, "Delinquente, how dare you?" And this is basically what my mom would say to me if I got married without her being there, although my parents don't believe in asking for permission to marry, so...
She'd be mad if you got married without her?
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. If you could see the look on Corinne's face, right? Like, I never knew that. I never knew your mom was sentimental like that.
She would not let me live it down. She still has not forgiven my Uncle Tim and my Aunt Rena for getting married without inviting her to the wedding.
Why didn't they invite your mom?
They got married, like, at, like, City Hall.
And, oh, okay. So they, like, eloped,
like,
kind
actually,
of?
Actually, yeah. Like, nobody even knew that my Uncle Tim was dating anyone. And
did
then,
he knock her up?
No. He did not knock her up. But I do think that she needed a green card at the time. So I think that things were expedited, you know?
Got it.
They're still together.
Right.
Many years later. But regardless, he got married. My mom didn't know. And she's like, why didn't you invite me? And they're like, it was just at the City Hall. And she's like, I don't care. So yes, if I ever get married, if there's one guest that's coming, aside from you, Tam, is my mom.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
That's one thing, like, a lot of my family members eloped, because I can probably count on one hand how many weddings I've gone to.
Uh-huh.
And some people are like, oh my God, I've got like 7 weddings this summer. And I'm like, why don't people in my life get, like, married proper style? I don't understand it.
Well, if you ever get married, Tam, I would want to be there.
Out of spite, I'm just going to elope in City Hall and not invite anybody.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. Anyways, you can either picture Tomas saying all of this, or you can picture my mom, all 5'2" of her with her curly short hair, saying this.
And her lovely purple glasses.
Yes. My Little Pony glasses. Yes.
Yes, 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 yes.
Tomas continues channeling my mama.
Does she say delincuente?
Yes. I invite you into my home, and this is how you repay me by stealing my daughter and getting married in that joke of a church without a priest, without my consent? He's practically shrieking, and Alex and Jeff stand frozen. But then Tomas throws the bat down and says, "You're not even a man. You're a thief." Then, seemingly defeated, goes back to his truck and leaves, while Jeff murmurs in disbelief, "Jeez, in-laws." That night, Isabella's venting to her bestie, Lainey, while making dinner in Alex's kitchen, which is technically hers now, too. Her father has disowned her, so Isabel has disowned him back. And her mother is lighting every candle in the city because Isabel is a sinner. Isabel's mood shifts when Alex comes home with Jeff in tow. They have huge hearts in their eyes for not Alex and Jeff, but Alex and Isabel have huge hearts in their eyes as they say, "Hello, my wife. Hello, my husband."
You don't know Alex and Jeff's relationship. They've known each other way longer than him and Isabel.
It's true. And they were hugging in the supply closet. Right? So, yes, yep. You're right. Mm-hmm.
And he's inexplicably there in Vegas. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know. And there's no reason for him to be there. Like, I still can't figure out why he was there. But then again, I don't think that a business based solely on building nightclubs is a good business idea either. So there you go.
Well, that shows how much you know about building nightclub businesses. Uh-huh.
Yes, it does. So while they're setting the table for dinner, Lainey comments on how sparse Alex's home decor is. Isabel says playfully, "Not after I spice it up." And Alex responds, "It's only for 4 months." Isabel asks, "What happens then? You turn back into a pumpkin?" Alex looks at her with a realization, saying slowly, "No, then I move back to New York." Jeff and Lainey give each other a look as Alex and Isabel have a back and forth about how she lives in Las Vegas and she likes it here and her family's here. That's what I say, like, to any guy. I live in the Bay Area. My family's here. I'm not moving anywhere.
I can totally see you marrying a guy after 2 days, Corinne.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
100%. Before learning anything about him because you're that impulsive.
No, I already tried having a guy move in after a short period of time. because I thought it would be a good idea financially, and it was a bad...
It was not.
Bad, was bad idea.
Very bad idea.
Yes.
Very, very bad.
Yes. So after that, I proceeded more cautiously, and since then, I haven't really made it past the third date with most guys. So there you go. While Alex argues that he lives in New York City and his work is there, and Isabel's never been there, so she may like it, too, if she gives it a chance, Lainey tells Jeff, see, this is the kind of conversation people generally have on their second date. Lainey, you are so wise.
It is technically their second date. No, third. Third.
Yeah, their second date was a wedding.
Yeah. The third date, she moved in. The issue doesn't get resolved, and the next evening, Alex comes home after work to a totally different house. The exterior has been painted a marigold with multicolored trim, mm-hmm. and inside, Alex finds the walls are all painted various shades of orange and pink. There's large crucifixes on the wall, and about 15 Mexicans in his living room talking loudly amongst each other. Once he's inside the door, he's attacked by a small chihuahua that latches onto his pant leg and starts shaking it. He cries, small thing, biting my leg, small thing, biting my leg, before Isabel rushes over and introduces her dog, Che. She explains, my family came over and spent the whole day painting and decorating the house as a wedding present. Not everyone feels the same way as my father. Alex is still slack-jawed, trying to absorb the changes when Isabel whispers, say thank you. Alex blurts, thank you. But Isabel accuses, you don't like it. He assures her he's never lived in something so bright. It'll just take some getting used to. They sit on the stairs together while Isabel asks, hey, what'd your parents say when you told them about us? Alex admits, oh, I forgot they're in Europe for the summer.
They don't have phones in Europe?
Shh, Brent. Shh. Isabel points out, it's April. And he quickly changes the subject. Wow, did your family do this in one day? I should hire you to build the club. Isabel smiles. You can't afford us. And then she gets hearts in her eyes and hands Alex her tiny dog and says, oh, you're so cute. I'm going to get my camera to take a picture of my new family.
Aww. We then get a montage of the two and their merging lives. Alex at his job, Isabel at hers. Isabel peeing in the bathroom while Alex brushes his teeth. He tries to scurry away, but she chases him down and brings him back because that's what married people do, pee together. The couples that pee together stay together. Isabel shakes her booty in the kitchen as she cooks. Unbeknownst to her, Alex watches like a creeper from the doorway with huge hearts growing
in his
eyes.
That's his wife. He could be a creeper if he wants.
No, it's cute. And other parts growing in him, too. That's what Tammy said.
I said on him, not in him. He doesn't have a parasite.
Excuse me.
He's got a boner.
On him, too. Boner. Boner, boner, bo boner, banana fan, a fofoner, fee fi, momoner, boner.
Chinese Spanish now.
Boner, boner. Then one evening, Alex fixes a picnic of sorts for him and Isabel at the half-finished nightclub. The walls aren't all erected and plastic sheets cover the main room. As he informs his wife, we officially opened last night, but I wanted you to be the first guest at our best table. He takes her to a small table with pizza and a fucking carton of milk. Are you for reals? Milk and pizza? Ew. No, that is too much dairy.
I want a divorce.
Seriously, just because I'm pregnant doesn't mean I need to have milk with my pizza. Mm.
Uh-huh, it's the calcium.
Mm-hmm, sure. Calcium. The milk is in an ice bucket. Isabel is charmed and tells him everything is perfect. But I would tell him, what's up with the fucking milk? As she puts a slice of pizza on his plate.
I think we all gathered that, Corinne. I don't think you made that a secret at all.
Oh, I'm sorry. Next time you come over, I'm preparing some milk with our pizza as well. How are you going to like that?
Just because you don't like it doesn't mean that automatically I have to. You know I hate milk too.
Uh-huh. See?
As I said before, love cheese, love it in cooking, in a big old glass. No, thank you.
Alex says, no, perfect would be if we were in New York and this was a Gray's papaya hot dog. Why didn't we eat Gray's Papaya hot dogs when we were in New York? Is that a real place? Does it exist?
Yes, it does. And we didn't because we were gorged with all the other delicious food that we came across. Had we watched this beforehand, we probably would have, because one of our quintessential New York moments was having a street dog, although yes. It wouldn't be a street dog because it was in a restaurant.
Okay. Isabel's not familiar with Gray's Papaya hot dogs. And he informs her they're the best hot dogs in Manhattan, a few blocks from his place. Isabel counters, well, if we were in Mexico, we'd be eating albondigas. Thank you. See, you helped me with my pronunciation. Albondigas.
I know Mexican food. I don't know Spanish, but I know Mexican food.
My great-grandmother makes it the best. And those are like little meatballs in a kind of a soupy thing.
Meatball soup.
Yes. Alex keeps steering the conversation to how great New York is, and Isabel keeps steering it away. The next day, she complains to her mother while they're in church lighting candles. You wouldn't believe it, Mama. He was all New York this and New York that. Mom sympathizes with Alex, saying he has a family to support. But Isabel insists he can do that in Vegas. They have lots of clubs opening in Vegas. They can use his particular skill set in Vegas all the time. They can do it together. Mom reminds her daughter that marriage is about compromise, and Isabel smirks and says, well, I sure picked my battle today. I had the guys and Shuey pick up Alex to take him shooting. Her mother gasps, and although they were about to leave, Mama turns tail to light another candle for Alex's safety, but I don't think there's enough candles in that church to protect him. Meanwhile, Alex is in the back of a truck speeding into the desert. All Isabel's brothers are there, glaring at him, and Juan asks, what's this about you taking Isa to New York? I bet my life she won't go. Alex scoffs nervously and says, no one expects anyone to give their life, right? He's met with silence and adds, right, Chewie? But Chewie just glances at him and doesn't respond as Alex shrinks lower in the truck bed.
Meanwhile, Lainey and Isabel are having lunch at a casino, and Lainey asks, so what are you going to go by? Are you going to change your last name or do the hyphenated thing? Isabel's old school and says, just call me Mrs. Alex Whitman. A blonde at the next table hears this and immediately turns around. It's Catherine, the one Alex has been avoiding since the third grade.
Yay.
She apologizes for eavesdropping and says, I'm sorry. Did you say Alex Whitman, the one from New Cane, Connecticut? Isabel's not sure where he's from, so Catherine continues, late 20s, brown hair, talks with his hands. Isabel chuckles and says, yep, that's Alex. Catherine asks how they know each other, and Isabel tells her, well, we're married. And Lainey adds, and they're having a baby. Catherine's face is not hiding her shock, and there's an uncomfortable silence as she stares at Isabel in disbelief before saying, I'm sorry, I'm Kathy Stewart. Our families know each other. Isabel greets her back enthusiastically because she hasn't met any of Alex's family or friends. Meanwhile, Alex and 10 of Isabel's relatives are walking across the desert rocks, guns poised. Alex has stopped to take a leak and admires the view, saying, wow, I can see why you guys all like it up here. The rocks, the open spaces. There's a low, I can't do a rattlesnake. Nope. There's a low rattle. Thank you. How can you do a rattlesnake and I can't?
You sound like a sprinkler.
I'll just say it, not spray it then. There's a low rattle that stops Alex in his tracks as he adds, the snakes. The relatives quickly rally and circle Alex, who has 3 to 4 angry rattlesnakes at his feet about to strike. On three, the guys shoot around Alex's feet, effectively killing the snakes but causing Alex to jump into a bunch of cactus. Mm. A couple of hours later, Isabel is back at home and hears the doorbell. When she opens it, the guys are holding a very drunk Alex, who says, Lucy, you got a lot of splaining to do, flat by his arms and legs. She begins smacking all of them as they enter and lay him on the floor, yelling, I told you to make it special not to kill him. Alex's back is covered in cactus prickles, and Juan tells her, we gave him tequila for the pain, before ducking out the door, leaving the newlyweds alone. Isabel tells Alex not to roll over, she's going to get the tweezers, while he unsuccessfully tries drinking from the bottle while laying flat on the floor, and instead just soaks the carpet and attempts to lick it up.
He committed to that, too. He, like, literally poured a bit of the tequila onto the carpet and like, he lapped on that carpet with his tongue. I was like, damn.
He really licked the carpet and not in the nasty way.
A week later, Alex is in good spirits, but still using a butt pillow to sit down while reading a parenting book. Isabel is flitting around him, cleaning, and she tells him to move because she's got to mop the floor. Alex says, I know what this is. You're nesting. And Isabel agrees because she just can't seem to get the house clean enough. She grabs his ass and he cringes in pain because there's still a prickle in there somewhere. She playfully takes down his pants to inspect the area and he's all for it. Yeah, baby. Until she says, I forgot to tell you, I met your friend Kathy the other day. Alex immediately grows serious and stands Isabel up. You mean Kathy Stewart? Isabel nods and adds, yeah, that's her. I think she was jealous. Alex begins peppering her with questions, but is interrupted by, ding dong, the doorbell. He goes to answer it and is shocked to see a well-dressed older couple in their summer suits, smiling. It's his parents, grinning ear to ear, saying, surprise! Alex's mom adds, Kathy Stewart said we just had to come down here and see what you're up to. Okay, now that was fucking bitchy as hell that she did that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. She plays the nice girl, but she don't play nice.
Well, and honestly, like, I think it would have been nicer if she had just told them than having mm-hmm. them show up and not know.
Yes. And if I did do that and I was Kathy, I would be parked across the street in my car with the AC on and my pocket popcorn.
She
went down.
She installs some like listening devices and video equipment in the house when Isabel and Alex are out so that she can get like a real view of it.
Not creepy at all.
Not creepy at all.
No. Worth it, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Alex's mom says she practically insisted. Isabel pops mm-hmm. her head around the corner asking Alex, who is it? And he promptly goes outside and shuts the door behind him, explaining, she's cleaning the oven and there's bad fumes. Dad's eyes boggle as he says, now that's a housekeeper. Ew, 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 ew. It's not long before Isabel pops outside to see what's going on, and Alex tries to introduce her, but in a moment of panic, forgets her name. She sadly introduces herself, and when she learns it's Alex's parents at the door, she greets each of them enthusiastically, hugging them and inviting them inside. Isabel offers the couple a cold beer, and they both accept. And once she's gone, Alex's mother says, she's wonderful. Of course, there's probably a lot of good help around here, being so close to Mexico. While Alex's dad gawks at the decor and says, this is the company house? You think they could afford a decent decorator? Alex asks his parents to sit down just as Isabel returns with beers, asking, how is Europe? You're back so soon. His parents scoff. Alex, you know we never go to Europe in the summer. Too many tourists. Isabel's face falls, and she curses him out in Spanish before storming up the stairs. Alex follows after her, while his father sings quietly to his wife, sounds like someone's getting fired.
Mm-hmm. Upstairs, Isabel cuts Alex a new one for being too cowardly to tell his parents the truth. And he defends, my parents are not like yours. But Isabel's not having it and yells, excuses, excuses. My father won't speak to me, but I told him, and you can't even be mm-hmm. bothered to pick up the phone and tell your parents what's going on? Mm-hmm. Alex argues, I was going to tell them eventually, causing Isabel to open the bedroom door and stand there expectantly because there's no time like the present.
Amen.
So Isabel and Alex walk back downstairs hand in hand, and at the landing he says, Mom, Dad, I have some interesting and exciting news. I'd like to introduce you to Isabel Fuentes Whitman. We're married. His parents are frozen until his mom utters a low, oh, God. We cut to a couple of days later at a lake. It's Cinco de Mayo, and there's a holiday crowd playing in and around the water. The Whitman and Fuentes parents and their families are on a double-decker houseboat. At first, Tomas refuses to meet Alex's mom and dad, but Isabel and Amalia threaten him until he reluctantly goes down below to talk. They all exchange pleasantries, and Tomas asks them if they had enough sunscreen, Tamara. It's not hard to say. Sunscreen on
And they just say, oh, it's fine. We'll just stay in the shade. Tomas cuts the shit and says, Señor, I'd like to tell you something. I don't think these kids know what they're getting into. Alex's dad leans in because he couldn't agree more. Marriage is hard enough without adding differences to it.
Oh.
Alex's mom, who's had one too many margaritas and a change of heart, says, well, I find it terribly romantic. Alex's dad tries to shush her, but Amalia adds, I don't think you men remember how foolish you were when you were pursuing us. Tomas ignores this and pushes on about where they're going to live and what religion the baby's going to be. And there's a stalemate, and the conversation quickly goes south as the Fuentes parents say the baby has to be raised Catholic because the mother's Catholic, while the Whitmans insist the baby should be Presbyterian. Amalia states matter-of-factly, Presbyterian's not a real religion, which causes Pa Whitman to raise out of his chair and claim, oh, years ago, settlers left Europe to escape religious persecution, and the Whitmans were one of them. This causes Tomas to stand up and yell, when Mexico was stolen from my people, we vowed they would never take our culture.
Yeah.
Pa Whitman scoffs, you call this culture? A boombox and guacamole in the middle of a desert?
Ooh.
Tomas yells back, now you're making fun of Amalia's guacamole? Which causes Pa Whitman to yell back louder, in case you haven't noticed it, the white people are melting.
This is good. This is all really real good here. And the white people were a melting. Because we next see the Whitman's parents riding the escalator back to their hotel rooms, beet red, with sunburns. Well, you give me fever in the morning, fever all through the night. And obviously, extremely uncomfortable. Fever when you kiss me. Fever when you hold me tight. Later that night, Alex and Isabel argue and defend their respective parents' points. For Alex, it's racism and being a Presbyterian. Both kind of indefensible, not because there's anything wrong with being a Presbyterian, but his parents are like, oh yeah, we go to church at Christmas time, and that's it. While her parents are like, we go to church all the time. So it's like, get over yourselves. And
there was a priest on that boat.
And Isabel, it's being Catholic. Things get heated and they go to bed angry. The next day, Alex is venting to Jeff, and his friend encourages him to stop trying to be the decent guy and get out while you can.
Oh, that leads all kinds of stuff to that whole, like, how much does Jeff actually like Alex conversation having earlier. Oh, he's trying to break them up. Shocking. Do they need to go back into another supply closet and hug some more?
I know. Well, and I thought they were going to hook up Jeff with Isabel's friend, or they were going to have him, like, get a little actively flirty with the blonde from alcohol licensing. But none of that happens. No, no.
There wasn't enough time. There simply wasn't enough time, Corinne.
Sure. I think our theory is playing out. Jeff continues, also, you got to get your head in the game. We almost got shut down by OSHA on Cinco de Mayo. Alex mulls over this information, and even though he should be working, he leaves to meet Isabel at her doctor's appointment. Isabel is already on an examination table when he finds her. Now, I find this part a little bit confusing because he says, Isabel, I haven't been completely honest with you. And I'm like, what hasn't he been being completely honest about? And we never find out what that is, because they've already had the he thinks they're moving back to New York conversation. They've already had the parents find out Presbyterian Catholic conversation. So what hasn't he been being honest about? I don't get it.
Maybe that he's so confident in their union and he was like, we need to get married. And now he's having reservations that maybe they didn't do the right thing.
Maybe.
Which is a fucked up thing to say to a pregnant woman on an examination table. I'm just saying.
He looks like he's about to tell her something heavy when the doctor comes in and introduces herself. She quickly gets to the first ultrasound, and Alex is surprised and smitten by the images of their baby, which are always fairly vague and unintelligible to me.
I'm like, oh, it looks like a bowl of porridge in black and white.
I know.
Amazing.
She's like, and here's the baby's head. And I'm like, is it though? Is it?
Oh, we're so maternal. Oh, my God.
Oh, my gosh. and the speedy heartbeat that he can hear through the computer speakers. He kisses Isabella on the forehead, and she apologizes for the night before, and he does too. Crisis averted.
He is a forehead kisser. I'll say that about fucking Alex Whitman. He must have kissed her forehead like 3 or 4 times in this movie. And I'm like, can you stop? Can you stop doing that?
Tamara knocks it one dry kiss because too much forehead kissing.
I might like attribute it to the fact that she's kind of like she's a little bit on the petite side in height, but she's usually laying down when he does it. So that's like just thwarts that theory all to hell.
We next see Alex back in the front of his nearly completed nightclub, trying very hard to focus on work, when Isabel drives onto the job site. She wants to steal Alex away for an afternoon. Jeff tells LaPere that they're behind schedule, but Isabel is undeterred and says it's Alex's birthday and she won't take no for an answer. Alex gives his friend puppy dog eyes and asks, will you cover me? Jeff reluctantly agrees, and the couple speeds off to a picturesque vista that overlooks the desert. And now, this time, Isabel has prepared the picnic. She regales Alex with a story about a family of squirrels that were separated by the canyon. They adapted to their different environments, but inside they were the same squirrel. Alex asks, In this canyon, will they ever be able to cross it? Isabel nods.
For a second, I thought you were getting all touched about the squirrel story.
No. No.
Okay.
Not touched. I was like, oh, so his white, super rich family is exactly the same as her Mexican-American family. Sure, Jan, sure.
No, because they grew up on the wrong side, the other side of the canyon.
Uh-huh.
See?
Uh-huh. They may look different, but they're the same inside. Medically, yes. Culturally, I would say no. I choose her family, Pikachu. Thank you. Although his family does have a helicopter, ostensibly, so, you know. Isabel nods and says, well, I've been thinking about it a lot, and if we can stay here until the baby's born, I'll move to New York. Alex is thrilled and kisses her as she assures him, I'm not saying I'm gonna like it, but I'm gonna try. He happily agrees, and she says, good, now I can give you your present. She fishes out a box from behind her and divulges that she asked her mother-in-law for a favor, and she sent them a box of Grace Papaya hot dogs, yay. Nothing like hot dogs that have flown across the country.
I thought the same thing. I'm like, how long did it take those hot dogs to get there exactly?
Seriously.
And they're not in dry ice. They're like in a warmer box. Like, I'm like, so.
Yeah.
If the Gray's papaya hot dogs are gray, is that a bad thing?
I know. And like, let's just say you won't get food poisoning from it. If there's any kind of sauces or whatever on the buns, those buns are going to just be soggy and shot to hell. I mean, like, yeah. No, it's not like there's a teleporter for them. So, no. Let's just go to New York to taste the Gray's papaya hot dogs, not get them transported across the country. Mm-mm. I'm glad that you were thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Alex is floored by the gift, and they both eat their tubes of meat while looking over the canyon. And Alex says, this is the best birthday I've ever had.
I never got the gift of food poisoning.
Until today. Oh.
But things aren't going well on the work front. Alex gets a red ticket shutdown after the workers accidentally drop a sign on the OSHA inspector's car during a visit. Later that day, Isabel is regaling her mother about it as they're lighting their candles in church, saying, "Ay, Mama, it was a sign." Amelia agrees and says, yes, it was for him to quit that job and stay here with you. And Isabel corrects her, no, like an actual sign with neons and lights and stuff. Amelia marvels that no one got hurt, and Isabel agrees, telling her mom that Alex had to go back to New York and it didn't sound good. We cut to Alex back at his work's New York office, and he's feeling the heat from all the delays and mistakes. Alex assures his boss that he can open the club in Vegas. Good typo, Tamara.
That's Vegas
with the B, not Vegas with the B.
Yes.
Vegas. You're going to get the club open in Vegas in 3 weeks. And his boss responds, well, if you can do that, then I'll be forced to give you the Midtown Club. Alex marvels that he's still being offered the job until his boss adds, we break ground July 1st.
Alex hesitates because the baby's not going to be born until October, and he made a promise. But when his boss asks, is there a problem? Alex assures him there's not. He's on board. And then we get a montage of the next few weeks. Alex working morning till night and growing more and more distant from Isabel. The lack of attention doesn't escape her. And the next time Isabel and Lainey are at the casino working, she's venting and informing her friend, Alex is different. Something happened in New York and he's not telling me anything. Surprisingly, Lainey's on his side and reminds her friend that he's trying to open a club with a tight deadline and probably just has a lot on his mind. But Isabel's not convinced. Her pregnant spider senses are tingling.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's being completely dismissive towards her, so she's being way cooler than I would be under those circumstances.
Right, but we only see the montage, and honestly, like, he might have said, like, I really gotta bear down and pay attention, and we just see, like, the, like, fleeting moments where he might not be like that all the time, but, you know, montages don't tell the entire story. I don't know if you know this, Corinne.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a snapshot.
Well, I will tell you, there's like a baby shower going on and he's leaving and he won't even like take a look at the onesie that she's holding up that she's saying is cute before he heads out the door. I'm like, you can look at it and be like, oh, that's super cute. Thank you so much. Okay, I love you, baby. Bye. You know, give her a forehead
kiss.
It looks
like he said something, but it was kind of like flippant and like probably said, like, I gotta go. I'm late, whatever. But yeah, I'll give you that. The
and
baby shower thing was kind of a...
stood her up at the baby store. She was waiting for him at the baby store and he never showed.
I'll give you that, but all the other times she came to his job site and stole him away when he should have been working, I'm gonna give him a pass.
Finally, we get to the opening night of the club. There's lights and crowds and the place is hopping. Isabel and Lainey are there, dressed to the nines, and Isabel is visibly pregnant. They see Alex across the dance floor, and he holds his arms up in triumph at his successful opening. They meet amidst the crowd, and Isabel tells Alex that she's so proud of him. He thanks her, but then gets serious and says that he needs to talk with her about something now that the club's open. Because doing that on the opening night on the floor of the club is a great idea, Alex. Super, super duper idea.
Yeah, I think he just did it because the clock's a ticking and we'll find out why.
Uh-huh. He gets pulled away by a tiny emergency in the kitchen. Isabel lets him handle his business because she has him meeting in the ladies' room. Be back real soon with Lainey.
Uh-oh.
They are powdering their noses in the innocent way, not in the white lines going through my mind kind of way of cocaine. When Isabel gets a
that is like the same genre and time frame as meeting in the ladies' room.
Uh-huh.
We're so current. We're so very current. Oh my God.
I know. Well, and actually some of the music that was playing in that club scene, it like brought me back. I was like, oh.
They played Naked Eyes by Luscious Jackson, and I was like, oh my God.
With my naked eyes, I saw her pouring rain coming down on me.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about at all, Corinne.
Isabel gets a sharp pain in her stomach and sits down in a restroom chair. Classy. Lainey offers to get Alex, but Isabel refuses, saying, it'll pass in a moment. It does, and she wanders back out onto the dance floor to find Alex at a table, sitting with some suits. One of them is his boss, Judd, and Alex cheerfully introduces the two until Judd tells Isabel, while shaking her hand, I knew if I dangled the Midtown Club in front of your husband's nose, he'd get back in line. And just think, by this time next week, you'll be New Yorkers. I hope you've packed. To Isabel's credit, she maintains her composure until Judd heads out, and then Isabel leaves in a huff.
In a huff!
Alex follows her out, saying, there's nothing I could do. The job starts next week. Isabel doesn't break stride and demands, tell them to wait. She shakes her fist at the sky, declaring, curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal!
And then lightning strikes.
Alex argues, I can't wait, that is. And she faces him, accusing, you can't or you won't. You have to be here every step of the way. And why do you keep alienating me? We're a family and I love you. Why do you keep shutting me out? Alex stammers, I don't know. Isabel regains her composure and stiffens. I told you I have no problem with raising the child on my own. And she slowly starts walking away. He yells after her. I thought we were a family. She turns back and cries. You don't know the meaning of family. To you, it's just something you tolerate on holidays. Love is a gift, Alex, not an obligation. Her voice cracks and she hurries away before she completely breaks. But what she said has incensed him, and he yells angrily at her retreating figure. Ooh, Alex, don't do it. Don't do it.
He's going to do it. He's going to do it.
He says, this is the brass ring I've worked my entire life in opportunity for. I'm not giving it up just because I put a $5 ring on your finger and married you in front of Elvis as a witness. Sticks and stones, but bitches, that hurts. No. Her distant cries let us know that she heard him. Can't take that back.
Cannot. The next morning, Alex gets home from the club opening, but the house is empty. He's only there for a few moments when Lainey calls. We don't know what Lainey says, but we next see him running into the maternity ward. He finds Isabel in a hospital bed, and when she sees him, she turns her back on him. He asks if the baby's okay, and she says sadly, there is no baby. He tries to come closer to comfort her, but she doesn't turn around and instead says,
What is that?
It's your lost boy song.
You have to strategically place it, Corinne. It's not the time. Not the time or place.
It gets strategically placed right after she said, there is no baby.
Weedy, 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 weedy.
Yes, thank you.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that really sets the mood.
Uh-huh.
She just lost her baby.
Yes.
Let's play. I cried like a little boy.
By exactly. Devotchka.
Exactly. During that touching scene. Oh, my God. Oh, anyways. This scene, I have to maintain my composure and find my stride. Damn it. Damn it, Corinne. Hold on. Center myself. He tries to come closer to comfort her, but she doesn't turn around and instead says, Alex, this isn't going to work, and we both know if it wasn't for the baby, we would never be together. He tries to argue, but Isabel is undeterred and continues. I thought it was fate, that there was a sign, but it was just my stupid belief. And now I know we'll never work because we're too different and we'll always be too different. Alex, please, let me help you, especially right now. But she doesn't want his help and screams at him to get out. Get out! Over and over again until he retreats out the door and she crumbles back onto the pillow in tears.
Aww.
Alex tries to return the next day with the bouquet of flowers, but Isabel has already checked out. He then goes to her parents' house to look for her, but Tomas slams the door in his face. Mm. She's not there anyways. She's heading to Mexico. We see her driving down the road in her... Hold on, I fucking wrote this down because
yes,
I had to Google
it.
It's an International Harvester Scout.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a Jeep, almost.
Yeah. Almost like one you see in the Outback, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's convertible.
Yeah.
And she's driving that, heading to Mexico to visit her great-grandmother in Aguascalientes. We get a montage of their time apart. Alex giving chi to Isabel's brother, with his moving truck waiting in the driveway. Isabel finding refuge and healing. Che, did I say chi?
Yeah.
Alex giving Che to Isabel's brothers with the moving truck waiting in the...
I was like, Che, is he like doing some feng shui? Is he doing like, I can't remember what it's called.
Tai Chi,
yes, thank you. Is he doing Tai Chi? I was like, I'm so confused. Oh. And then I was like, wait a minute. No, this is the dog.
Che, not chi.
Yes.
That shows how different we are because when I said chi, I thought of my hair straightener, my chi hair straightener.
Oh, yeah.
She's where our values are. Uh-huh. Are so far apart, Corinne.
Yes.
Will we ever be able to cross this canyon and be together?
Well, you know, I am a squirrel on the other side of the canyon. You know, the more spiritual, mm-hmm. transcendent side.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I am on the
superficial hair straightening
superficial
side.
Superficial hairstyle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But I look good.
Yes.
But I look good.
Yes. I don't. I look like a hot mess. It's okay. My squirrel hair hasn't been combed in a while. It's just standing up all over the place while your tail is luscious and perfectly coiffed. Bushy and
beautiful.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Isabel's finding refuge and healing with her great-grandmother, but inexplicably she breaks down one day when she's at church. Alex in his high-rise New York apartment watching the 4th of July fireworks, and ultimately on his new job site at the Midtown Club, which is nothing more than a mound of dirt between a couple of high-rise buildings. Jess shows up there, imploring Alex to come with me Friday night on a double date to the Yankee game. Alex is not feeling it, but Jeff needs him because the girls are a package deal. Just then, a well-dressed woman approaches the two, asking, "Are you Alex Whitman?" Alex confirms he is, and she serves him with divorce papers and tells him he has 6 days to contest. At the end of this, I didn't write this down because it was kind of funny, because the lady's like, "You've been served. Have a nice day." And he's like, "Oh, thanks, you too." It's like, that's something I would say. "Oh, you're serving me with divorce papers and telling me to have a nice day. Go fuck yourself."
Well, and I'm like, this is like the quickest, most expedient divorce ever. Like, how is this even working?
With her not even in the country.
Yeah, I totally did not get this magic divorce that she's getting.
I think some time has passed, because I know he moved July 1st, then it was July 4th, and so maybe it was trying to show that there is some weeks or months that have gone by, because she wasn't due until October, so they might be in, like, August?
Yeah, like, oh, 2 whole months have passed, like, or 1 month has passed. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. Anyways, yes.
Maybe all she had to do is be like, "Papa, I want a divorce." And he's like, "On it."
Yeah, seriously.
"We're going to get your cousin Diego, who's a fucking attorney, to, like, expedite this paperwork.
And Chewy will make sure it gets delivered properly." Yes. Yes. Meanwhile, back in Mexico, at the Mexico Hacienda, Isabel is having a heated argument with her great-grandmother, Nanita. The old woman is accusing Isabel, "You think you know better than love?" Isabel turns towards her, crying, "He never would have left if he knew I was still pregnant." And he didn't leave. She's the one that left. He was still, like, pursuing her. Then we all pause for a moment to realize, in all the previous scenes, since the breakup, Isabel's belly was hidden, much like in sitcoms that use strategically placed items to hide their pregnancy. And now that we see that she is still very pregnant, but I totally saw that coming a mile away and immediately thought she was lying about not being pregnant anymore when she was in the hospital.
I didn't. I just thought that when I was back, when I first watched this movie, I'm like, oh, sucked all the air out of the room because I didn't see it coming.
I totally was like, and I would have said something, but I thought you might want the moment of suspense or whatever, the reveal.
There was a moment of suspense. I wasn't as, you know, knowledgeable and wise as I am now back then. So maybe that's why it was shocking to me. So I just wanted to replicate that experience for our gentle listeners.
Well, you know, when you have, like, all the chi and spiritual energy that I do, you know about these things.
And also, how could I replicate that for the gentle listeners when I'm telling them about that and they didn't see all the fucking scenes with her belly being hidden, Tamara? Good job.
Well, you didn't mention that she was pregnant in any of the scenes, so you were hiding it with your words. Isabel argues, "I let him off the hook." But Nanita knows better and responds, "You let yourself off the hook. But why do you want to leave the great love of your life?" Isabel slumps on a chair and admits, "Because if I didn't leave him, he would have left me. And I don't think I would have been able to handle that." Nanita gets on her knees in front of her and tells her, "Isa, you will never know true love until you surrender to it." Which causes her first they call her the grandmother, then they call her the great-grandmother. So I, you know, having an additional great in there, it totally makes sense because we're just piling on the greats.
Maybe she's wonderful. She's just a wonderful great-grandmother. So she's a great-great-grandmother.
Her great-nanita, yes.
I also want to point out that this whole conversation was in Spanish with subtitles, and this is the part that I was pondering whether to put it in Spanish and have Corinne read it in Espanol and thought better of it. So you're welcome.
I thought about it and I was like, too much work. Yeah,
exactly.
Which causes her great granddaughter to burst into tears, Back in New York, Alex is at work and gets a call from Kathy Stewart. Yay! The shark who smelled blood in the water. She says sweetly, I heard about the breakup, and I'm so sorry, not sorry, but our parents are going sailing this weekend, and I was hoping I could convince you to come along. Alex is annoyed at first, but has a change of heart and says, why not? In the following days, Alex is met by some interesting coincidences. One night, while leaving work, a priest standing outside tells him, there are signs everywhere. Alex asks, what do you mean? And the colored man says kindly, you look lost, son. There are signs everywhere to guide you. The next day, he almost trips over a fellow New Yorker's dog who looks exactly like Che, the Chihuahua. On his way to meet Kathy and his parents, his cab stops next to a Caesar's Palace advertisement. Then a Kodak advertisement of a beautiful desert scene.
It hasn't been that long since Kodak was a thinker.
Oh my gosh. He finally makes it to the helipad because the fucking family is flying to a boat in a fucking helicopter, like a large ass fucking helicopter. What the fucking fuck? Yep. I don't think they have nun powers like Sister Act, so it's got to be a pretty pricey ride.
Yes.
And Kathy practically Velcros herself to him, kissing him softly on the cheek. Huh? No, you don't kiss me softly on the cheek, Kathy. I'm sorry. Mm-mm. While he greets their parents, and what kind of shitty gender bullshit is it? He hugs his mom and shakes his dad's hand, hugs Kathy's mom and shakes Kathy's dad's hand, which is just odd.
Yeah.
He seems to be growing more and more reluctant to go on this trip when he notices a pretty dark-haired girl staring at him. She looks almost like you would imagine a little Isabel to look like. Everyone files outside to get on the waiting helicopter, and Alex hesitates in the doorway. The little girl runs after him, and her mom calls, Isabel, get back here! And that clinches it. Alex goes out to the helipad. The parents have already piled into the helicopter, and Alex whispers something in Kathy's ear and walks away. Kathy sadly gets in, too, but not Alex. He hesitates a moment to wave goodbye to everyone, then sprints towards the street. His dad looks confused, and his mom looks at him softly, blowing him a kiss, and, I suspect, knowing that he's gonna get the girl.
Oh, yeah. And then we hear, Donkashay, darling Donkashay. And we get a mashup of the enormous effort Alex takes to get to Aguascalientes, Mexico. He takes a tiny plane to a tiny airport, then boards a crowded bus sitting next to large men holding chickens onto a donkey led by a small child who drops him off in front of the hacienda. Whew. Alex rushes inside and finds Nanita and tells her, Buenos dias, yo me llamo Alex Whitman. Estoy buscando a Isabel. ¿Está ella aquí? Nanita knows who he is immediately and tries to answer back that Isabel returned home to have their baby, but Alex's Spanish is not that good, so she simply says, A Las Vegas! His face drops with the realization that he came all this way for nothing, and she cups his face in her hands and says sweetly, So you're Isabel's true love, my sweet boy, in Spanish, and kisses him on the cheek. He smiles at her, surprised by the reaction, and then sighs because he's got a long trek back. We see Isabel driving back through the desert, listening to Elvis's It's Now or Never, Come Hold Me Tight. Great soundtrack, by the way. While Alex has found a regular-sized plane to fly back to Vegas in, he's in the airplane on the phone with Lainey, begging her to tell him where Isabel is. She finally relents and says she's on her way back and will probably cross into Arizona around 8 p.m. Alex is thrilled. He has a plan. His plane lands, and he promptly takes a cab right to the Arizona-Nevada state line in the middle of the Hoover Dam. He's only there for a few minutes waiting when it starts pouring rain, because of course it is. So he stands there in the wide open, getting drenched, waiting to see her recognizable car, which I stated earlier is an International Harvester Scout, which is the only way he'd be able to see that car because it's raining and dark, and he sees it in the distance
And even though, like I said, it's raining and dark and visibility sucks, he stands in front of her car as it's speeding towards him, like at 60 miles an hour. Alex does not make great decisions by standing in front of cars. We've seen this.
Bad decision dinosaur is at play.
Yep, he's going to get hit someday. I guarantee it. She's reaching for her wishing coin in her glove box and almost plows through him, but screeches to a halt, causing all the other cars around her to also skid to a halt. Once she realizes who it is, she gets out and is pissed, yelling, "Alex, what are you doing, trying to get us both killed?" He yells back, "I'm not giving you a divorce." She tells him it's over, and he says, "Not until midnight," and then starts gushing happily about all the signs he saw, the priest, the chihuahua, the desert, and even the girl named Isabel. She throws up her hand, saying, "I don't believe in signs, not anymore." And Alex yells, "Yes, you do. You were wrong. The baby didn't bring us together. It was something else. It was fate."
Isabel has a small smile on her face, but remembers her predicament and starts walking away from him. And when she does, he sees her figure and cries, "What the hell is going on with your stomach? You're still pregnant? How could you lie to me about that?" He follows her down the rainy street as people shout angrily and cars honk at them. Okay, let's pause for a moment here, because there's more than one lane. Her car is blocking one lane. There are other cars that they skidded, but they did not hit. They did not crash into each other. No cars were harmed this whole situation. They just need to, like, back up and turn around, and they can just keep on going, and they'll be fine. But no, they're just a honking, parking there, being like, "Why can't we move?" Because you're not moving. There's a thing called an accelerator. You just put your foot down on it, and you go.
If you can't see it, you can't see it, folks. But Corinne's flopping her hand up and down, miming an accelerator.
Yes.
Thank you, Corinne, for that. I didn't know what an accelerator was until I saw that. Appreciate it.
You know,
And it's also called dramatic effect.
Yes.
The car's parking, not your hand. Although that was also dramatic effect.
So. There's more dramatic effect coming up that I'm really dubious about. So.
Okay.
He follows her down the rainy street and people shout angrily and cars honk around them. She finally stops and tries explaining that she was trying to get a hold of him but couldn't, then changes tactics and says, "I know I lied to you, but you lied first." Alex grabs her hand in his. There's no trace of anger. Instead, he happily says, "I know, but we're here now and I'm here now. We're having a baby." Just then, Isabel doubles over and groans, "No, I'm having a baby right now," and starts going into labor. She's like, "Oh, my water just broke." So she's like, "Call the ambulance." And I'm like, "Why don't you just get into the passenger side and Alex can get into the driver's side and he can take you to the hospital? It's going to be faster than a fucking ambulance, yo."
Because they turned the streets inexplicably to a parking lot and there's too many people parked between there and the hospital to get there in time, Corinne. How can you not know this?
Right, yes. So speaking of dramatic effect, I was like, when somebody's water breaks, you just move them into the passenger side seat and you just drive to the hospital.
Cue the dramatic effect.
Within a few moments, the police arrive and they can't move her because the contractions are right on top of each other. So she is forced to have the baby right on the street. Dramatic effect. In a damn storage shed. In the dam. On the dam. Wow. Why? In so many layers. Why, when her water broke, Alex just didn't drive her to the hospital and her car is beyond me. In the throes of her contractions, she curses Alex out in Spanish. And when the attending officer asks, "What did she say?" Alex ad-libs the translation. "She says that she loves me and never wants to leave me." Isabel screams in pain and yells, "Alex, go away. You're bad luck." But then grabs his shirt and pleading says, "Please, please don't leave me." Alex leans in and says, "I love you and I'm never leaving you again." Isabel gives one final push and the police officer declares, "It's a girl." Alex kisses Isabel's forehead and they're handed...
Curse your son, but inevitable betrayal, Alex. Another forehead kiss, Alex.
They're handed their baby. The police officer says, "I hope you have a name for the baby because it's coming now." Do we ever find out the baby's name? No, we do not. A short while later, the traffic is gone, the rain is cleared, and Isabel is sitting in the back of an ambulance with her newborn daughter. Through the open door, she sees Alex on the border of Nevada and Arizona. He has Isabel's wishing coin, kisses it, and flings it over the dam before making his way to his new family. Isabel chuckles and says, "Don't you think that's a little superstitious?" He shakes his head. "I'm not taking any chances." He kisses his new daughter's head, just like again, he kisses Isabel's, and then realizes it's past midnight and sadly informs her that they're officially divorced. They look into each other's eyes before breaking into a smile. Then we hear Elvis singing, "Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you." It plays and we fade to Isabel and Alex's remarriage ceremony, which is atop a desert vista looking over the Grand Canyon. But this time, all of their family and friends are there to experience it with them. The end.
Woo! Encore, encore. Never mind. It's too long. Well, you gotta go.
Tamara, what is your dry kiss rating?
Well, first of all, let's remind all our gentle listeners what our ratings mean. If we give it one kiss, that means do not watch. If we give it two kisses, that means if you had only three channels, you might watch it for a while before changing to an infomercial and then inadvertently buy yourself knives and then feel guilty, particularly when they don't cut a can as advertised. So many regrets. If we give it three kisses, that means, yay, would kiss this movie again. Four kisses mean this is a date night you've been waiting for. And five kisses means if this movie were life, you had gotten dressed by cute cartoon animals, some squirrels, immaculately washed your dishes, and you rode to work on a unicorn. Ooh. And I give this movie, and you might not agree with this, Corinne, I do love this movie. I have loved it ever since I first saw it. And I would not watch it now again because I realized I watched it incessantly in like the last 20 years since it was released. But I give it 4.5 dry kisses. Particularly because it speaks to me, yes, and there's a reason.
Oh my gosh.
I grew up exactly like Isabel and Alex. My mom was white, my dad was Mexican, and so I completely relate with both sides of these stories. My life growing up was culture shock. My mom came from an affluent family, my dad's parents picked vegetables in a field. And I felt so many of these moments so strongly. Like, I think it gave grace to both families while allowing both cultures to show their ass a little bit. Mm-hmm. Alex's parents were uppity assholes. Isabel's dad was showing the fuck the patriarchy by, oh, you know, you need to ask my permission and blah, 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 blah. So, like, that's why this movie spoke to me. I do like Matthew Perry. I loved him in Friends. He was one of my favorite characters. So seeing him in this role, particularly when it was at the height of his fame, was kind of nice because it was like seeing Chandler, but in a different show. Mm-hmm. And I loved Selma Hayek in this movie.
Yeah.
She wasn't really well known, but I was like completely charmed and like, oh my God, who is this girl? Like that whole thing. Like when I saw Julia Roberts, I'm like, this girl is beautiful and talented. And I love that it was also in a time when you didn't see, I think this was when Mexican, like with Mexican people speaking Spanish based movies kind of gained their popularity. Mm-hmm. And I like seeing that side of my culture in movies. Mm-hmm. And you didn't see it a lot. And you didn't see it as real and honest as it was. And so I do give it 4.5 dry kisses. And I stand by it.
Well, I really like your reasoning. And I give it 2.5 dry kisses. Because
I figured you would.
I will not be watching this movie again. I totally agree with you about Salma Hayek. I don't dislike Matthew Perry, and I actually think I liked his acting better than you did in this movie. But mm-hmm. there's some movies where the endings just kill it for me. And this is one of those movies where the ending, I was like, oh, this is just like after the fake I lost my baby scene, I was like, okay, we're done here. What? No, this is stupid. So, yeah, it lost me after that. But all of your points, I agree with and I appreciate, which is why it gets 2.5 dry kisses instead of 2. Because while I would not watch this movie again, it was an okay movie. And I felt like there were definitely some strong points to it. So, yeah.
Also, this was based on a true story. And I looked it up, but it was actually a couple. She was Hispanic. He was white. I don't know how much of the story is true, but at the time when I found that out, like, I did a deep dive. And so it was based on real people, but they did, sadly, at the time I looked it up, got divorced. So aww, that was kind of a bummer. Yeah.
Well, at least one of them wasn't trying to kill the other one. So there you go.
I guess there's that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad that I saw the movie because I'd never seen it. And so
I also just love the way that they gave both of the nationalities had their pros and cons,
mm-hmm.
and they were flawed and they weren't vilifying one versus the other.
Yeah.
I think they were being very fair in portraying them, which is not common, generally speaking. Like, they're either stereotyped or this one's the bad guy and this one's the good guy.
Yeah.
So I think it was like a really honest representation. And I struggle a lot of times with my identity. And I remember this one time, I think I might have mentioned it before, where on my white side of the family, one of my little cousins was playing house and she picked my white relatives to be the mom and the dad and the baby. And she looked at me kind of like, and you could be the nanny. And I'm like, my heart, oh, my heart.
Yeah.
So like all of those like little quirks and those little jabs like also resonated with me because they happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I hate the fact that you see me and think you're the help.
Yeah.
Instead of you are one of me. And mm-hmm. So when they're like, oh, you've got good help because you're in you're so close to Mexico. And I was just like, reet.
Yeah. No, and I was totally thinking about that, like when his parents were like, oh, you have a maid, you know. And I think that if I had watched this when it came out, I would be much more attached to this movie than I am.
Yeah, I think if I watched it now, I would be less attached to this movie as I am. This was like one I had as a VHS and a DVD. And it's like, once it went to Blu-ray, I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm good. But, you know, it's one of my all-time like favorite rom-coms that I forgot I liked so much until I watched it and I had to like write it out. And I'm like, there's so many great lines in this stupid freaking movie.
Yeah.
Watch your head. Why does it come off? Oh, my God.
Okay, so now
I think we just need to cut to the chase and just say there's one musketeer here, no more.
Yes.
That is, guess which one it is.
Racial diversity. Bow, 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 bow. So one musketeer shows up to the table. No body diversity, no sexual diversity, no disability representation.
Although if we do go along the storyline with Jeff here, there might be a little undercurrent of a gay love story, but that's just a musketeer that only lives in our minds and
yes,
probably nowhere else.
That musketeer is hiding in the closet. So next we have our wild card categories. Ooh.
I'm going to pick this week. My grab bag pick is going to be the alternate movie title.
Ooh.
Instead of Fools Rush In, I'm going to call this A Bad Love Story of Tamara's Parents in reverse. Because my mom was the Caucasian one and my dad was the Mexican one.
And I will choose the title, Oops, I Fell in Love.
And then, oops, I got pregnant after that.
Yeah, exactly.
What grab bag topic do you want to pick this week, Corinne?
Left in a huff. If they just up and left the movie, it would be so much better. The person who needs therapy.
Oh, my goodness.
I choose our friend, Kathy.
Fair.
I mean, she's just hanging around Vegas. Why is she just hanging around Vegas? She doesn't live there. She just is like hoping to somehow run into Alex. It's just
odd.
That's
a good question. Because I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, wait, are they from Vegas? No, I don't, she wouldn't. She doesn't seem like the Vegas type.
No.
Maybe she just has a gambling addiction.
And still, she still needs therapy. So, yes.
Right. I'm going to say blatantly, Isabel. One, it would be a completely interesting and different movie if she never went back to his house and just had the baby and then they reconciled or found each other later on down the line. That would be like a completely different movie. But she also might need a little bit of therapy because lying and telling somebody that you're not pregnant when you are is really fucked up.
Also, if she had actually not ditched out at 5 a.m., and
yeah,
she had stuck around just to begin with.
Also.
Yes.
Fair point.
Yes.
They might have just decided to, oh my God. Although, like they said, if they went on that second date and she's like, oh, you're from New York? Never mind.
I think their attraction to each other would have overcome that. I wonder if Matthew, to your point about Matthew Perry and love scenes, I wonder if the reason why they did not include any kind of zingy connection to begin with after the bathroom line and they just cut to them being in bed the next morning, if it was because they shot a scene and it just didn't work.
That's an interesting hypothesis, Corinne.
Well, yes, it is.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, so Tam, very important question. What movie do we have coming up next week?
Next week, it's Corinne's pick, and she is picking A Legally Blonde as our next April Fool movie.
Woohoo! And we are also going to be talking in that episode as well about, we're dedicating this episode to Let's Go to Court.
Oh, yeah. Let's Go to Court. R.I.P. Let's Go to Court.
The podcast that we love.
Yes. Brandy spending beautiful time with her family.
Yes.
Kristen's got some wonderful new projects on the horizon that we're excited about, but we are still mourning the loss of our most favoritest podcast, at least mine,
yes,
in the whole wide world, and wish all of those ladies nothing but success and happiness.
Absolutely. So we're just going to be talking about, be a little bit in our feels at the beginning of the show. And one of the reasons why we are doing Legally Blonde is because Kristen actually covered Legally Blonde as a, quote, court case as an April Fool's joke on Brandy, which...
So it's also fitting.
Yes, yes. So it's a perfect full-on episode. So if you have anything you would like to say about Fool's Rush In, as well as Legally Blonde, you can email us at onedrykiss@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us via the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at OneDryKiss.
And that's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you could find the time to rate or review us anywhere you listen to this podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. But in the meantime, we'd like to thank you for stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one
dry kiss.
Mwah. See you next time.
See you next time.
Yay! Damn, that was a long one. 'Don't do either of those things when I'm sunburned. I will cut you.
I got it.
You do? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.